from KQED.
And welcome back to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. While you may have used A Lonely Planet Guide to find lunch in Paris or a music venue in Cuba, its latest guidebook spans our planet and even reaches into outer space. Dark Skies, a practical guide to astrotourism, details 35 dark sky spots, offers some stargazing tips, and ventures into the future of commercial space travel. And joining me now to talk about all this is Valerie Stimmick. She's an Oakland-based travel and space tourism writer and author of Lonely Planet's Dark Skies, a practical guide to astrotourism. And welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Delighted to have you here. And we should mention right off the bat here that you grew up in Alaska, so you could see Russia like Sarah Palin, right? No, actually, that kind of got you hooked in this whole business of stargazing, didn't it?
It did. I was very fortunate. I grew up watching the Northern Lights on a pretty regular basis, and I also have distinct memories of seeing the Hale-Bopp Comet in 1997.
That's all pretty exciting stuff. Of course, it's getting more difficult to see all these beautiful things in the skies because of dark skies, and I want to talk with you about that. But before we do, let's talk about some things that people may indeed be able to see, beginning with the Geminis meteor shower. It's up ahead soon.
It is. The peak is expected to be on, I believe, Friday evening, overnight Friday to Saturday. Unfortunately, it's right after the full moon, so it's going to be pretty bright in the sky unless you want to stay up quite late. The potential is the moon's going to interfere with the ability to see the meteors.
Well, lots of exciting stuff coming out. December is a great month, in fact.
It is a fantastic month for stargazing.
Yeah, let's talk about what's in December. I mean, there's first of all, total solar eclipse coming, right?
There is, yep.
And what else? Rocket launches, if you like that sort of thing, the aurora, but maybe particularly I'm thinking about particularly, I guess, some of the meteoric things. Let's talk about those.
Yeah, absolutely. There, in addition to the Geminids meteor shower, there's another sort of major meteor shower called the Ursids that happens right after Christmas. And then a lot of stargazers, amateur astronomers, have been looking for the interstellar comet Borisov, which is passing through our neighborhood, so to speak. It's expected to make its closest approach to the Earth on, I believe it's December 28th.
That's an interstellar visitor, so to speak. I mean, that's how you're billing it.
It is. It's come from somewhere outside of our solar system.
And what's the best place for observatories? I was surprised that up at Sun River at the Oregon University is supposedly really just about the best in the U.S.
It's one of the best, absolutely.
About 30 telescopes?
Yep. Hawaii, the Big Island, is a great opportunity as well. And then throughout the Southwest, so Arizona, New Mexico, nice clear skies, low humidity, so not a lot of interference with the ability to see the night sky.
But if you want to see dark skies, it's much better to go to places, I guess, like New Zealand and Scotland, maybe. There's not a lot left. It's diminishing.
It is. Unfortunately, there's been a lot of development of light pollution over the past few decades.
Only 99% of U.S. residents, close to 99%, can no longer see the Milky Way because of light pollution.
Yeah, I have lots of friends who've never seen the Milky Way at all.
Sad.
It is sad. I was very fortunate because growing up in Alaska, it was common to see the Milky Way.
So what do we do about that? I mean, what do we do about it, especially in light of the fact that we have astronomers very concerned about somebody like Elon Musk now sending up all those satellites? What's he set up, about 120, but plans for some thousands of them to go up?
Yeah, I've been following that pretty closely. Of course, people ask me my opinion on things that might interfere with our ability to see the night sky. And from what I understand, all of the rest of that particular constellation of satellites will have anti-reflective coating on them. So hopefully they won't interfere with, basically, they interfere with professional observation more than amateur observation. But hopefully that will solve that.
Do we need more regulation?
I don't know that regulation is necessary, because most of the people who are trying to put things into space are doing it from the same base of interest that the amateur astronomers are, which is a passion for the night sky, a desire to better understand our planet and our place in the universe. So I don't know that we'd necessarily need it at this point. Increasingly, as more companies are able to launch products and afford to launch products because the cost of launching is going down, we may need that in the future. But for now, I believe most people have an earnest care for protecting the night sky enough that they will self-regulate rather than requiring the governments to get involved.
Our guest is Valerie Stimmick, and she is travel and space tourism writer, author of Lonely Planet's Dark Skies, a practical guide to astrotourism. And the interest in stars and stargazing and the skies and space has been going up. You got over 20 million people who actually traveled in the United States in 2017 to see the solar eclipse. A lot of this tourism, though, is also affecting, well, what can be seen. I mean, also affecting the dark skies, yeah?
100%. It's a balancing act. And I talk a lot about that when I meet with people saying we need better tourism infrastructure, but it has to be responsible development. So if you need to put in a new hotel to meet the demand of people stargazing in a region, those light fixtures on the outside of the building need to be installed properly from day one. You can't just put in these spotlight lights or light the facade of the building. That's going to interfere with what's bringing people there in the first place.
Yeah, that's on the one hand, all this rise of astrotourism. On the other hand, the need for, well, not necessarily, I mentioned regulations before. That's our dirty word to some people, but at least real local concerns. And your advice is, you know, treat it like you would a campsite. I mean, I think that's essentially very wise and useful advice. Let's talk also about going into outer space or going into space at least. I mean, it's definitely in the future and people are signing up now.
It's the near future. The last headlines that I saw is that Richard Branson is still saying that they're going to launch they're launching something before the end of the year, and that's coming up quite quickly.
What do you envision or what is envisioned here? I mean, we're going to go to the moon, clearly, probably.
We are. Elon Musk actually has a paying customer who's going to do a flight around the moon. It's a little bit harder to estimate timelines, but the earliest phase of space tourism, as in normal civilian citizens going to space, will be what's called a suborbital flight. So it's a launch that sort of just grazes the edge of space or crosses the imaginary line into space, but isn't like going around the planet. It's not going to another destination in space. And that's a relatively short experience. And it mostly is intended to give people a perspective of the planet. It's called the overview effect, where people come back from having seen our planet in space with a better perspective on how fragile and special our one tiny blue dot is. And a lot of people come back with very environmental mindset. So there's some sort of mission-driven idea behind space tourism that you can give people that experience and they will come back and try and help protect the planet even more.
I'll use your pun. Space tourism is taking off, right?
I have lots of space puns like that, yep.
But the cost will come down, and that's imminent too, isn't it?
It is. I believe you'll see within our lifetimes the cost trajectory come into the range of Antarctica. So if you think about Antarctica, when people first started journeying there, one, it was pioneers, it was explorers. And then as ordinary citizens started to go, it was very cost prohibitive, very expensive. And it's come down significantly in the course of several decades. I think you'll see the same thing once the reusability and regular flights start occurring.
And you can find out all about this world of astrotourism in Valerie Stimmick's book. It's called Dark Skies, A Practical Guide to Astrotourism. The advice is if you're going to be an astrotourist, especially with events, you should book well in advance, especially with this escalating astrotourism industry that we're talking about here. And you may have questions or comments, and please feel free to join the program now. Let me give you the toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls, and please feel free to join us now. If you have questions or comments, 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions or comments you might have to forum@kqed.org or post them at kqed.org/forum. Other recommendations we can get from you, the things that are coming up soon?
This month is the big month, and then it sort of tapers off for a few months as we move into the new year. Personally, this is an interesting time to start looking at planning aurora trips for the spring. So the peak activity for the aurora across the globe is typically around the September equinox and the March equinox. So if you want to try and go plan a trip for the aurora, looking at mid to late March and checking which destinations you can see that. Actually, I was working on a story yesterday about seeing the aurora from Russia. So for the truly adventurous, intrepid travelers up there, that's an option. It's not just about Norway and Iceland. Those countries get a lot of tourism and there's great infrastructure. But if you're a little more off the beaten path as a traveler, there are great options as well.
And there are things coming up, though, with respect to getting closer views of Mars and of Venus and of the moon fairly soon, right?
Yeah. So what's typically throughout the month, every month, there are what we call close approaches, and that's where the moon and the planets come into very, very close proximity. And given certain times of the month, you can use the moon to get a really clear idea of what you're seeing. So as the moon is moving through the sky, it may pass very, very close to Mars or it may pass very close to Venus, and that helps you see it, especially if you're trying to use binoculars or a telescope to find Mars or Venus if you're not familiar with the night sky. You can use the moon and those close approaches to know, yeah, I'm definitely looking at Mars. I can definitely see Venus.
Well, again, if you have questions about what to see or about the night sky, the dark skies, astrotourism in general. I'd also like to pose a question to listeners. If you could travel out in space, where would you want to go? Would you want to go to the moon, or would you want to go to Mars? Or for that matter, well, it'd be more difficult probably to go to places like Venus, obviously, but or Alpha Centauri or anything else that may come to your mind. But it'd be interesting to hear what those of you would like to do in that sense of space tourism. Let me get a caller on here, a caller under the name of Dr. Flash Gordon. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning. And that is my name, but that's another story.
That is your name, really?
That is my real, genuine name on my medical license. Mortgage doesn't get any real than that, more real than that.
That's,
anyhow,
this brought to
mind an episode when I was 5 years old, living in New York. My folks took me to the Hayden Planetarium up there. And I distinctly recall that Pan American Airlines, or the late Pan American Airlines, had a sign-up book for the first commercial flights to the moon. And I remember being so excited that I was signing up for that. This is the early 1950s. And, of course, Pan Am is gone. I'm not going to go, no matter what, apparently. But it's interesting that this interest was still there enough to get a company like Pan Am to actually put out a waiting list back in the 1950s.
And that's what, I was at the Hayden, too. You want to comment on that, Valerie?
Sure. I've been nodding over here. I actually do know this story because I've done some research into the history of space tourism. And I believe it was somewhere in the range of 6,000 to 7,000 people who signed up and wanted to go on a flight. Most fascinating, of course, is that this has been an interest ever since we started sending people to space in any capacity. And unfortunately, it just hasn't been possible due to the cost. And the private sector is obviously what's solving that. Now that we have private individuals funding space companies instead of the government, that's what's been able to actually bring this idea to life.
And I thank you, Flash Gordon. Good, Dr. Flash Gordon, good to have you aboard with us. I was going to ask you something else about Borisov, which is also called the Christmas Comet, which we talked about before. I talked about it as an interstellar object because it was the second one, I believe, ever identified. Best date I'm reading is December 6th to see it?
Yeah. So
how do they come to that?
So there's two different dates that people are keeping in mind. Now, December 6th, it was when, I believe it's when Borisov was at its closest approach to the sun, or it was a point where it was very visible. But unfortunately, as we're moving toward the full moon right now, it was potentially inhibited by the light pollution from the moon. And then the closest approach to Earth will be right around the 28th.
And a listener named Otters writes, my favorite astrotourism sites are Zion, anywhere in New Mexico, but especially White Sands and Magdalena, Death Valley and Joshua Tree, although I don't want to encourage more tourists there. On my bucket list are Crater Lake and Salar de Uyuni. I love that there are dark parks to visit. And let's, for a moment, focus on that, if we could, with you, Valerie. I mean, dark parks, I keep reading about Idaho. There's actually a reserve in Idaho.
There is. Yeah.
Where else are there reserves?
The other reserve is... And this is a great pop quiz question. I believe it's in Texas. West Texas was the second dark sky reserve that was certified in the U.S.
So what other good places to go to, though? I'm looking, for example, another listener, Orlando, says Lassen Volcanic National Park during their dark sky festival is fun. How good is the dark sky views there?
It's good. I haven't been yet, but it's funny. When I started working on my book, one of the people within the Lonely Planet ecosystem said that they were traveling to Lassen to see the dark skies because the festival was coming up. And that's what's sort of interesting is what I'm finding as I talk to people is there is obviously a range of how dark the sky can be. But for most of us who live in urban areas, we don't need that most dark sky possible. We just need enough darkness to be able to enjoy the basics of what's in the night sky, seeing the planets and understanding they're there.
If you live in the suburbs, you cannot find that.
Correct. So we don't need necessarily to go to these dark sky reserves. Obviously, those are great. If you are exceptionally enthusiastic about the night sky and you've seen it several times, you keep wanting darker and darker places with better quality stargazing. But for most of us, if we're making that one trip or that first trip, we can go to somewhere that's a little bit nearer, might have a little bit of light pollution. So, for example, Joshua Tree is actually plagued with a fair amount of light pollution from the Coachella Valley, but it's still a great stargazing place because most people can't see even half of the things that you can see from Joshua Tree from their own home. So it's still a good destination.
Valerie Simic is the author of Lonely Planet's Dark Skies, A Practical Guide to Astrotourism. And another listener writes, outside Bryce Canyon National Park, we paid a private company for a dark sky talk and telescope viewings. It was cold but informative and beautiful. I had to mention, you know, Bryce and Zion, I was there a number of years ago, but they're almost like especially Zion, it's like walking in a moonscape. I mean, you actually feel like you're an astro tourist.
You do. Yeah, I was in Zion in April doing some stargazing. So I have a friend I travel with, and she likes hiking. So we hike during the day and we stargaze at night. And I found that whole area is just fascinating because it's such an otherworldly landscape. And if you get the right stargazing conditions, you really can imagine yourself on another planet, though there's nowhere that's quite like Earth. I've been learning a lot about the other planets lately, and nothing has the same features and geological points of interest that we do.
Although we don't know really all the planets that are out there. We're just discovering planets in other solar systems and so forth. I just want to put in that cautionary note because
very true.
Probably many universes, in fact. But here's a listener who writes, any environmental enlightenment brought by space tourism will never offset the detrimental environmental effects of rocket launches.
Is 100% a very valid point, and something that I've increasingly been getting questions about is that the launches are an exceptionally carbon-heavy footprint. I agree. I think that this is something that these companies will be facing questions about. That said, I don't think the train is going to stop pulling out of the platform. So it's
good. The genie's out of the bottle.
It is, and it's good for us to create that sense of healthy commentary on the activity to make sure that these companies, in addition to caring about their bottom line, are caring about the environment that they say they're also trying to protect.
I'm glad we're bringing that up. In fact, here's another listener who writes, I'd love to go to space and see the aurora, but given the climate disaster, this kind of travel seems irresponsible. What's the carbon footprint of space travel? Do you know, Lisa?
I don't know that we have the numbers on that yet, especially for space tourism specifically, mostly because these companies haven't made a lot of launches. That said, there are much bigger ways we can reduce our individual carbon footprints than just by not going to space. Obviously, there are things we can do in our everyday lives that will have a much bigger impact from today forward.
And here's Joe who writes, I'd love to go to Europa and find out whether life exists under its icy surface. And here's another caller joining us. Richard, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Michael, and kudos on this wonderful program. I had the occasion years ago to both befriend and attend many of John Dobson's star parties and back in New England and out here in California. And one of the things that caused great all-night conversations was the idea of people lacking the ability to see the night sky fully. And of course, as you just established, this is not going to change anytime soon. And as the your guest properly said, sometimes it's wonderful to just see the basics, and there are still a number of places to get started on that. But the idea that you brought up earlier with the suborbital viewing, getting to see the horizon and the roundness of the planet is very similar to the idea of being able to see a full night sky. It was brought up in New Brunswick, Canada, on the Bay of Fundy. And
well, Valerie is nodding her head very affirmatively here with what you're saying, Richard. Let's hear what she has to say.
Yeah, Richard, I agree 100%. I have this working hypothesis that I'm still looking to secure grant funding for, which is to study what I call the Milky Way effect, the idea that seeing our universe for the first time has this dramatic psychological change in our minds to recognize our space in space. And I'd love to be able to study that. I'm hoping that at some point in the future, I'll be able to team up with the National Parks and the International Dark Sky Association to start asking people before and after they see the Milky Way how their perspective is changing. Because I do agree, I think that the night sky has an incredibly powerful effect on us and in a good way of teaching us our place and how to protect this one little area that we currently live in.
In fact, let me go back to you on this, Richard. It's the word that comes to mind most readily here is awe.
That was the beautiful and almost without question feeling every time that the sky was available. There wasn't fog. There wasn't clouds. It was stepping into and being surrounded by, feeling as though you were in a cloak of the most gorgeous and most extraordinary parts of our galaxy, of our world, of our universe. And that is so important to the spirit of the human, because we are so used to looking in our little lane, in our little box, and it's very difficult to get out of
that. Can also make you feel minuscule and puny, too. But I thank you for that, Richard. Well described. Good to hear from you. And we'll hear from some more callers. Let me go next to Bob. Bob, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, thanks for this program. It's really fantastic. There is a new dark sky sanctuary up in northwestern Nevada, and we go up to Cedarville. We pull up our 11-inch Celestron with us, and the night sky up there out of Cedarville is just mind-blowing. It's just mind-blowing. It's just it's a humbling experience. And the sky is so clear up there that we can really pull in a lot of stuff with our telescope. It's just delightful. So that's another spot where people can go. Accommodations are inexpensive, and it's a beautiful place to be in the high desert.
And a good recommendation, Bob. We thank you for that. Speaking of recommendations, Roger tweets, where is the closest dark enough spot near the Bay Area? Lisa?
So I would go...
Valerie, excuse me.
That's okay. Yeah, if I were... It sort of depends on how far you want to travel. And I found that generally in my research, I do a lot of research into urban stargazing spots because that's what most people are looking for. I would look at Mount Diablo and Mount Tam. And the reason I put Mount Tam, even though it's quite close to the Bay Area, is that they have an astronomical association. Friends of Mount Tam does events there. So they are confident in their location enough that they can show people the wonders of the night sky that close to the Bay Area. So Mount Tam, Mount Diablo.
Well, you've done a remarkable job with this book, Dark Skies, A Practical Guide to Astrotourism. What do you say to those people who say, I could just go to a planetarium, get the same thrill there?
If you want to start at a planetarium, that's great. But if you go to the planetarium and you're interested, please go out and see the night sky with your own eyes because it's going to be that much more impressive.
It makes quite a difference. Let me get Matt on next. Matt, thanks for waiting. Join us. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I had a question about can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. Go ahead, Matt.
Yeah, sorry. I had a question about space travel. How can we rarely, if ever, hear about the difficulties of solar radiation and radiation in general, and that right now we can't shield the astronauts in the spacecraft or with their suits when they're going to, let's say, Mars, that the radiation would most likely kill them on the trip there and back or severely damage them. And then until we overcome that, we won't be able to go that very, you know, very far out in space without shielding the radiation.
Well, you're absolutely right, and NASA is working very, very hard on that. I was recently at an event down in Houston and got to try on one of their radiation vests that they're using for some of the female astronauts on the International Space Station. And so this is a high priority for NASA. And the nice thing is this is where there's a complement between government-funded space exploration and privately funded space exploration because the government can use their resources to do this research. And it complements the work that the private companies are doing. So absolutely high priority. That's why I don't think you're seeing anybody talk about going to Mars in the next few years, because that's one of the main problems we have to solve first.
And let me thank you for the call. I'm just wondering about, again, globally, places that really come up time and again, not only in your work, but whenever anybody broaches the topic of astrotourism, they seem to talk about Iceland a lot. They talk about Chile and Jordan.
Yes, Jordan. Jordan's one of my favorites. I'm actually leading an astronomy-focused tour there in March. I decided that nobody was offering the kinds of tours that I thought people might want to be going on, and I wanted to lead one if nobody else would. So, yeah, Jordan's fantastic. They're a great example of how responsible tourism infrastructure will need to develop because people are traveling there for the dark skies, but they haven't necessarily built tourism, you know, support, hotels, roads, street lighting to be promoting dark skies. So I think you'll see Jordan hopefully recognizing that and working to improve that for any future development. Chile is fantastic. I spent time there in March. I was sort of scouting the area for the eclipse that happened there in July. And they have fantastic, they're a great example, actually. They're a great example of what you can do if you want to support dark sky tourism because they have lots of private companies that have opened up what they call touristic observatories. So they exist just to be public facing. And there are tons of hiking tours, photography tours. It's all there and very, very open, very easy to travel in the region, even if you're not a Spanish speaker.
Wasn't your trip to Jordan involved with teaching about Arabic astronomy, which, you know, kind of was really ahead of the game?
Yeah, that's the goal. So Arabic astronomy is absolutely fascinating in that most of our understanding of what we might call Western astronomy has roots in Arabic astronomy because of the loss of language between ancient Greek and modern Greek. So really short story. When they lost ancient Greek translations of the original astronomical documents, they reached out to the Arabic astronomy community to try and translate through Arabic. That's why a lot of stars have Arabic names. A lot of things are still rooted in that. So I've reached out to the Jordanian Astronomical Society, and we're going to have a speaker come and do a short talk about Arabic astronomy and the heritage of the night sky in the Arabic-speaking world.
And we'll bring Darren on next, Darren. You're with us. Good morning.
Hey, thanks for having me. Absolutely. Just want to comment on the enthusiasm that I have for this topic and share a story that when I was a little kid, I was going to one-up your guest. When I was a little kid, my dad dragged me out late at night, a couple nights in the neighborhood. I grew up in Bend, Oregon. We got to look through the telescope and see Halley's Comet when I was a little kid. And then fast forward to 1997, I was in the military. And early in the morning, we'd fall into formation and stand there in ranks and get barked at with orders. And my mind and my eyes were in the sky looking at the Hale-Bopp comet at the wee hours of dawn. And it was just something that always set really well with me as kind of like a point of pride that I got to see these two high-profile comets in my life. And then the third story real quick, I got a chance to go to Mauna Kea a couple years ago and do some of the stargazing at 9,000-plus feet. And I actually got to see the Andromeda Galaxy and a binary star system, et cetera. And it's just one of those topics I always feel out of place if I get in a conversation with random people at a party or something, because I feel really like I'm the only one that likes this topic so much. So,
well, keep them all in your mind's eye.
Yes.
Thank you, Darren, for that call. Good to hear from you. Here's some listeners who wanted to weigh in. Michael said, in October during the PG&E blackouts, I was in Marin County. I got out of my car and looked up, and for the first time in the 28 years that I've lived here, I could see the Milky Way from my front yard. Another listener, Aaron, tweets, San Francisco State has a Sierra Nevada field campus that's only a few hours' drive from the Bay Area. The stargazing there is phenomenal, and they have hobby classes available for the public sometimes, especially in the summer. So there's a lot out there.
There is. Though we live in one of the biggest areas of light pollution on the West Coast, there are a lot of enthusiasts. The listener who was just talking about feeling like he's alone in this, he's definitely not alone. There are a lot of people who are passionate about the night sky. And we finally are having this sort of opening of tourism to the activity, and so we can talk about it and meet other people who are interested in it too.
Well, your book leads many into different venues in this context, and the book, again, is called Dark Skies, A Practical Guide to Astrotourism. Valerie Stimmick, spending this half hour with us, travel and space tourism writer and author of The Lonely Planet's book, Dark Skies. This is the first time, I guess, Lonely Planet has gone beyond our terrestrial borders.
They have, and there's a second book I worked on called The Universe. So if people are interested in deeper space, we have a book on that too.
Oh boy. And always remind listeners of E.E. Cummings' great line, there's a hell of a good universe next door. Let's go. So thank you for being with us. Good to talk to you, and congratulations on the book. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. You can actually continue this discussion online by going to our website, kqed.org/forum. Not sure we'll be back with you on tomorrow because lots of activity going on with the Judiciary Committee, but we'll talk soon. So stay tuned for more here on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.